Support for today's episode comes from Honeylove. For a limited time only, you can get Honeylove on sale. Get 20% off your entire order with our exclusive link, honeylove.com/weirdest. Support our show and check them out at honeylove.com/weirdest. Honeylove's best-selling crossover bra is so comfy, it's sure to be your new go-to. It gives all of the support of a traditional bra without any underwire. Honeylove has you covered for everyday looks, workouts, weddings, and more. Treat yourself to the best bras on the market and save 20% off at honeylove.com/weirdest. Use our exclusive link to get 20% off, honeylove.com/weirdest. After you purchase, they ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Honeys, you deserve this. The best way to learn a language is immersion. But if that's not in the cards, you can still learn a new language the second best way. With Babbel, you can start learning a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's approachable and accessible tools have helped me keep up and even improve my German skills between trips. Babbel's personalized learning content, real-time feedback, tracking, and visualization are designed to help keep you focused and motivated. Plus, all of Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by their 20-day money-back guarantee. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/weirdest. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/weirdest, spelled babbel.com/weirdest. Rules and restrictions may apply. At Popular Science, we report and write dozens of science and tech stories every week. And while most of the stuff we stumble across makes it into our articles, we also find plenty of weird facts that we just keep around the office. So we figured, why not share those with you? Welcome to The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week from the editors of Popular Science. I'm Rachel Feltman.
I'm Sarah Kylie Watson.
I'm Joel Cook.
Joel, welcome to the show.
Yay!
Thanks so much for having me.
Listeners, I came across Joel because of his show for PBS, which is called Rogue History, and does these really awesome deep dives. Joel, would you tell listeners a little bit more about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, so I started out as an archaeologist and a historian. I graduated from East Carolina with a master's, and PBS just kind of found me and reached out. Asked if I wanted to try out a little pirate show that they were doing. That ended up being Rogue History. It's been really successful so far. We've gotten into spies at this point, just all types of different cool little topics, and we're open to do more in the future.
Yeah, listeners who enjoy Weirdest Thing, which I hope you do if you're listening, I think you will also really like Joel's show. So we're super psyched to have you on to share some history knowledge. Let's get into it. On The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week, we start by each offering up a little tease about some kind of fact or story we found in the course of reading, writing, reporting, etc., and decide which one we just absolutely have to hear more about first. Then, once we've all had time to spin our little science yarns, we reconvene and decide what the weirdest thing we learned this week actually was in a non-competitive, everything is made up and the points don't matter kind of way. Sarah Kylie, what's your tease?
So I'm talking today about why rats might love taking selfies.
Great. Same. I am a rat who loves to take selfies. Who is it? Wonderful. Joel, what's your tease?
I'm talking about how the American Civil War saved the United States from being overthrown by a traveling barber.
Oh, I'm so excited.
My tease is that I want to talk about the birds that help humans hunt for honey, the lies that people tell about the birds that help humans hunt for honey, and how maybe that says something about like our society as a whole or whatever, shrug emoji, I don't know. Why don't we start with rat selfies, Sarah Kylie?
Yeah.
I'd love to hear more about that.
Yay, rat selfies. Okay, I've had this one like cooking for months. I'm so excited to talk about the rat selfies. So, yeah, first off, I'm going to start by talking about some selfie science. There's not really a lot of science out there on selfies, but I did manage to scrounge up a few numbers. According to a 2015 survey, millennials spend on average a total of 7 minutes a day capturing selfies. Worldwide, some estimates say that around 92 million selfies are taken every single day, representing about 4% of all photos taken. According to the Pew Research Center, 1 in 3 photos taken by 18 to 24-year-olds is a selfie. So it's safe to say that in the modern world, the self-portrait as important and iconic as it's ever been, and why we love them and why we can't stop taking them is still up in the air. So according to some researchers, selfies are able to like capture the deeper meaning or like, you know, like the hidden details of people's personalities or the events in their lives. But, you know, there's some selfie haters that are like, okay, people just take selfies because they're vain or because they're chasing likes. So still up in the air. Again, there's not a ton of selfie science, but luckily.
I mean, like, here's the thing is that before we had the technology to just take pictures of ourselves whenever we wanted, the people who had the means to commissioned wildly expensive like sculptures right. and oil paintings of themselves that took hours of human labor and then hung on a wall forever. And I think, you know, if they could have taken instead many pictures of themselves on a device that fit in their hand, would that have been better? No, we would have like almost no art because so much of art history has involved rich people paying for the art that they selfishly want. But, you know, I do think it's we haven't gotten vainer. Just the tools have changed.
Oh, no, I definitely don't think we've gotten vainer. I mean, if you... And the thing is, at least selfies, like, they're kind of you. I feel like a lot of, like, art is, like, I'm like, who is this? I'm like, when I'm looking at, like, medieval art, I'm like, this is simply not, like, this, like, inbred king who, like, has the same grandma as his wife. Like, I'm like, come on now. But anyway, I mean, selfies, they're imperfect in their own ways. But I'm going to get to the core of my discussion, which is other creatures might like taking selfies. But the reasons are similarly up in the air. So in this case, we're talking about these rats that love taking selfies, apparently. But even before that, you know, there's always like three befores in my statements. We're going to talk about the psychological experiment called the Skinner Box, which I'm sure has been brought up about a million times here. So if you're a regular listener, this is going to be just a follow up. But basically, the Skinner Box, it's an invention psychological experiment box from B.F. Skinner, who is a mid 20th century psychologist, and he's most famous for his like theory of behaviorism. In the 30s, he proposed this theory of operant conditioning that basically states that behavior change and learning happen when the outcomes or effects of punishment and reinforcement happen. So basically, like, it's kind of like training your dog, which is what I'm trying to do right now. I've got an eight-month-old puppy. Yeah, when they do something good, little treat. That's basically the core of, like, learning. So a response is strengthened by reinforcement, and as it increases, the likelihood that a desired behavior will be repeated again in the future. So, yeah, me tricking my dog into sitting and staying for a treat. I'm sure most of you guys have tried this in some shape or form. But the Skinner Box was kind of like the chamber in which this was developed. And he tested out this theory on like rats and pigeons when he was at Harvard. So the box basically had a lever and a snack tray. And you guessed it, press the lever and food pops out. Great. And then like a little hungry rat gets first place in the box and they're like, what am I doing here? I'm just wandering around. And then they figure out, oh, if I press the lever, I get a snack. And then all of a sudden they're just like, boop, 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 bonk, bonk, bonk with the lever. And so they've learned how to use the lever. It's awesome. So it's a great little trick. And this has been done over and over with different rewards for the rats. Like, I think they've done this with drugs. I think they've done this with zaps to their little rat brains. Like, over and over again. Like, this is a tried and true thing. So no matter what, they bonk, they get the nice thing. And enter reinforcement theory, which is basically saying individuals are rewarded for a specific behavior. The likelihood of that behavior occurring goes up. If individuals are provided with the opportunity to escape bad situations, they will be motivated to act accordingly. And if certain behaviors are not reinforced, they are less likely to be reiterated. So treat. Give a treat and you're going to see that behavior more often. This is the gist of it. And so fast forward to today, and we've got a Parisian photographer and grad student, Augustin Linier, I think. I'm trying to get my best Parisian pronunciation, but it's not really there. So he basically gave a little tweak to figure out if adorable little rodents like rats had a knack for self-portraits. So basically, he built a transparent tower with an attached camera, and then he put two rats in there. And when the rats bonked the lever, food came, or not food, it was a little sugary treat. So just a little bit of sugar. And it also set a camera off. And then the camera, basically the photo that was taken, would be able to be seen by the rats. So we've got this clear tower, bonk, treat, and selfie. Which came out to be like really, really cute pictures, which I will absolutely send to everyone because they are just so, I love rats too. I'm like such a like little fuzzy creature person. So this one is very exciting to me, pictures of fuzzy creatures. And they ate it up. They loved the button. They kept bonk, bonk, bonking the button, getting a treat, taking a picture. And eventually the sugar aspect of the experiment waned. So would they keep doing it even if they didn't get like the snack part of it? And they did. So every like time you bonk the lever, you don't get a treat, but every bonk meant a selfie. And they kept pushing the selfie button, even when there wasn't sugar. And sometimes they even ignored the sugar. After a while, they just were like, selfie is enough. Selfie is enough of a gift for me to keep doing this thing. And so, yeah, jumping into the conclusion that rats are in it just for the selfies is kind of a stretch, obviously. We can't really ask the rats, like, hey, do you think you look cute and that's why you're doing this? Which I would assume they'd say yes, because I'm sure they know. But it does kind of like tie in this experiment to our own relationship with social media. Scientists have proposed that social media is kind of like a Skinner box for people on their own. Like, just sure. Press the camera button on your phone, click through a couple of filters, and voila, maybe you'll be rewarded by like a like or a comment or, you know, a little DM if you're, that's what you're looking for. and this has been studied before as well. Bjorn Lindstrom, who's a professor of experimental and applied psychology at VU Amsterdam, did research of his own about this in 2021. So he looked at and analyzed 1 million posts from over 4,000 individuals across multiple social media platforms. And basically, his findings back up that the idea that human behavior on social media conforms qualitatively and quantitatively to the principles of reward learning. So, like, he even described this himself, which I thought was really charming. So I'll describe it to you about this, like, feeling of, like, okay, if I put my selfie out there, maybe someone will like it. So he did a little post in Springer Nature when his study came out, and he wrote, "The times I've posted caused a mixture of anticipation, satisfaction, and disappointment, all depending on the likes or lack thereof my photos received. Having spent much of my career so far applying computational models of reinforcement learning to human social behavior, I became more and more convinced that likes function as a social reward that encourages future posting. More specifically, my feeling of disappointment when getting fewer likes than expected or exhilaration when the likes kept streaming in seemed very similar to a prediction error, the difference between the actual outcome and the outcome one expected, which plays a key role in the psychology and neuroscience of learning." So, anyway, but in a completely different, like, view of this whole thing is that we just, animals, us, people, we just like pushing buttons in general, which made me laugh out loud when I was reading. The New York Times did a really beautiful write-up of this, which has all the photos and anything. That's where I found this study, which is from 2014. So basically, human volunteers preferred to, like, administer electric shocks to themselves instead of being left alone with their thoughts, quote unquote.
Right, yeah.
So according to the authors, most people seem to like do something rather than nothing, even if it's negative. So the rats might just like pushing the button because, you know what? Sometimes we don't need to be alone with our thoughts. And I guess a lot of us experience that. I personally, like, I'm a TikTok scroller till I die. Like, I totally relate to that. Probably even more so than the likes or dislikes as a treat. I'm like, I'm just mute my brain. I would like to see another, you know, silly video of a cat dancing. But there's no telling if it runs that deep with the rats. But at the end of the day, I love this experiment. I think it's totally cute. And the pictures are amazing. The rats, the photographer named them after himself and his brother, which is really, really cute. So you see him like talking about Augustine and Arthur with the names of the little selfie rats. And it's like just a fun reminder that as different as we think humans are from like the rest of the animal world, like we're just like not that different. Like we all love sugar and treats and rewards and buttons. So
yeah, we're so just hairy little guys pressing buttons. That's like, all we are.
Exactly. We're hairy little guys taking buttons. And now that we're not living in the art era, we can all see it forever. <It's> Everyone gets to see it. So yeah, that's what I have to say about rats and selfies.
That's awesome.
I love that. Yeah. Well, and it's so true that, you know, social media, it is definitely the like pulling the lever for the treat, even when the treat isn't really there. I remember back when we all actually used Twitter, they rolled out a change where like when you sort of tried to reload your feed, like if you tried to keep scrolling when there was nothing new, it used to be that it would just sort of like wiggle back and be like, there's nothing new. Stop.
You ran out of Twitter.
Right. Exactly. And then they changed it so that if you did that, it would start surfacing. It was basically the beginning of the like sort of for you page on Twitter where it was like, maybe you just want to see this other stuff. And people were like, why is it showing me this stuff? That's so stupid. And the answer was like, because we keep trying to get it to show us more stuff. So they came up with more stuff it could show us. And that
we
was
kept
really
pressing the button. Like that, and they were like, yeah, fine, have something.
That like, felt like kind of a gotcha moment. I felt got because I was like, oh, I do that, don't I? I've really tried to I took Twitter off my phone even back when I used it a lot, and I eventually took TikTok off my phone, and I want to get back to making more content on TikTok because I love it as a way to engage with people. But for me, the scrolling feels like something to keep under control, which I don't think is universally true. I don't think there's anything wrong with self-soothing with a scroll. I just think for me, it's gone to some dark places.
I'm very similar with my TikTok scrolling. I set timers.
I think it like setting timers is a great way to handle it, because it's like, listen, life is hard. There's nothing wrong with me wanting to be hypnotized by this screen. We live in a society, but maybe keeping it from stretching out into infinity. Amazing. Well, rats, they're just like us. No surprise.
No surprise.
We should be so lucky. They're wonderful creatures. We are going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with some more facts.
Support for today's episode comes from Honeylove. Let's face it, most bras suck, but Honeylove is different. Honeylove's bras feature supportive bonding that eliminates the need for uncomfortable underwire without sacrificing lift. For a limited time only, you can get Honeylove on sale. Get 20% off your entire order with our exclusive link, honeylove.com/weirdest. Support our show and check them out at honeylove.com/weirdest. I feel like I am constantly on the hunt for a bra that makes me feel confident, looks good under my clothes, actually supports my bosoms, etc. But as many brands as I try, I almost always come back to Honeylove. Their bras are just so comfortable. It's really hard to beat. Honeylove's best-selling crossover bra is so comfy, it's sure to be your new go-to. It gives all of the support of a traditional bra without any underwire. If you're looking for a more relaxed lounge bra, you should try their V-Bra. It's designed to lift and separate, which is, you know, ostensibly what you want a bra to do. And it's got molded cups, so you don't get like a uniboob. Honeylove has you covered for everyday looks, workouts, weddings, and more. Treat yourself to the best bras on the market and save 20% off at honeylove.com/weirdest. Use our exclusive link to get 20% off, honeylove.com/weirdest. After you purchase, they ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Honeys, you deserve this. Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples. Apparently, the human nose can produce more than 3 fluid ounces of mucus a day. And honestly, I believe it because I have terrible allergies and I'm congested all the time. As a professional podcast host, it probably doesn't surprise you to learn that I hate having to deal with seasonal allergies. It's not just physically unpleasant, it's also deeply inconvenient. Luckily for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. Designed for serious allergy sufferers, Claritin D has 2 powerful ingredients in just one pill that relieve your allergy symptoms and decongest your nose so you can breathe better. I've started taking Claritin D on days when my allergies are just especially undeniable, and it's been a real game changer. It really clears up my congestion and relieves the terrible sinus pressure I get, and it just makes everything so much easier. Ready to live your life as if you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Okay, we're back. And Joel, tell us some rogue history, please.
Okay, so it is time to put the conspiracy hats on because this is a conspiracy story.
My favorite
exciting.
Hat.
You see a whiteboard behind you with strings going everywhere just pop up out of nowhere. You know, like this is one of those stories. So Moses Dixon. Moses Dixon was born in 1824 in Cincinnati. His father was possibly his mom's former enslaver. Not a lot is known about their history, but his dad was white. His mom was black. They came from Virginia together. That's all we really know about them. And they ended up in Cincinnati, Ohio. Moses Dixon is born. He has 8 other siblings as well. And he's born into a very interesting racial time in Ohio. Really, any time in the 1800s in the United States is a very interesting racial time, to be fair. Not a great time. But in Ohio, specifically at this point, Moses Dixon experiences in his childhood 2 race riots in Cincinnati over Ohio's planned black codes. So they have these black codes from 1805 to 1807, and they try to reinstate them in the 1830s. And the rule behind that is that any black person who does not enter into a bond, which is basically just like a holding fee, and they have to pay a fee as well to stay in Ohio. Anyone who doesn't agree to do that is going to be sent out of Ohio. So anyone who can't afford to do this is kicked out. So it makes the population of black people in Ohio a lot smaller, obviously. So Moses Dixon is growing up in that kind of life experience. He loses both of his parents by the time he's 13. So he, you know, he has all of his brothers and sisters that he has to take care of. And he starts training as a barber under William Darnes. And here's my science part, because barbers at that time period were technically scientists.
They did it all.
You know, they were surgeons, like light surgeons and medical professionals in some ways, besides cutting hair. You know, they did a lot of different stuff during this time period. So he starts training as a barber under William Darnes. And interestingly enough, William Darnes is Mark Twain's barber. So Moses Dixon, this is the first time you're going to see him making a connection with someone else who we all know, but it's not going to be the last time, right? So yeah, so he's like Moses Dixon, he's kind of at the periphery of a lot of different stories, and Mark Twain is one of those first ones where he probably did know him and run into him occasionally. But after he does his barber training for 3 years, he leaves home at 16, so he leaves home in 1840, and he becomes a traveling barber on the Mississippi River. So during that time period, you have steamboats that go basically like a ferry service up and down the Mississippi River. So he joins up on a ship. He travels the Mississippi River for 3 years. He has all of the experiences that you're going to have moving up and down the center of the United States. And he, for the first time, witnesses slavery face to face. You know, like he's known about it. Obviously, his mom was a former enslaved person, but he's witnessing it for the first time. And he says that he witnessed such scenes of monstrous cruelty as caused his African blood to boil. And following that, he vows to use his privilege as a free black man to do something about it. So at some point in that, he also becomes a Freemason, which another layer of conspiracy. It's like, ooh.
Put it on the murder board.
Yeah, so like all the things are happening. He becomes a Freemason, and he also makes friends with 11 other people who feel similarly to him, 11 other black men. And they agree to assemble in St. Louis in August of 1846, and they form this revolutionary organization called the Knights of Liberty. And the goal of the Knights of Liberty is to eventually overthrow the institution of slavery in the South. So Dixon is elected as the chief of this group, and these 11 other men are spreading out through what we know as the Southern states. They're everywhere except Missouri and Texas. Moses Dixon, in the meantime, while this group is, you know, going out, they're recruiting men. They have to be people who are industrious and not, you know, they're looking for people who don't have, like, I guess, attitude problems in the way, because they need people who can keep a secret, people who aren't going to get fired up too easily, because this is a top secret organization. So, oh, yeah. You know, you imagine...
Gotta be careful.
Yeah, you imagine a random guy walks up to you and he's like, hey, do you want to join a secret organization that's going to overthrow the government? that's something you should probably keep a secret. You should probably not, you know, go to the saloon and be like, well, I'm a secret organization, you know what I'm saying? Like, so they're looking for people who can do that, who can stay quiet. And they're spread out, I mean, literally all over the South. They have people in Mississippi, in Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia. And they're working to recruit this army. And they're training at night. They're pulling people away from plantations to, like, go out. Because that's definitely a thing during that time period, is that people on these plantations, they're doing most of their personal things at night. So Dixon is saying that this is what some of these groups are doing, is preparing this 10-year construction of this army. So in the meantime, the Knights of Liberty are developing underground railroad connections as well, according to Moses Dixon. So Dixon himself, he goes back to St. Paul, Minnesota. And while he's waiting on his army to prepare to overthrow the government, he opens a restaurant because not only is he interested in violence, he's interested in fine dining. However, the restaurant
is relatable.
You know, the restaurant does not go well. He is lightly shot by an angry patron at one point. A light gunshot by a patron. I don't know what that says about how good that fine dining was, but it didn't last super long.
Everybody's a critic,
you know. Right,
it's a tough industry.
So he doesn't stay in the restaurant business long, but he does still have connections that he's making during this time period. So the 1850s, the time that we're talking about, is also the time where John Brown is moving around all over the country trying to stir up trouble for the radical abolitionist movement. Frederick Douglass is becoming a star, you know, on the speaking circuit. You also have the colored conventions that are happening. So colored conventions are they have gatherings in each state where all of the, like, premier, I guess, black people, like, W.E.B. Du Bois would call it, like, the talented 10th. These people are gathering and saying, okay, so what are we going to do for the next 2 years? What are we going to do for the next 5 years to protect our people and prepare our people for the future that we want? So he's present at the one in Ohio, the colored convention of 1850. And he's meeting all of the premier abolitionists at that place. He said that he knew John Brown. He said that he knew Frederick Douglass. It's probable that he knew Harriet Tubman as well. So he's making all of these different connections to all of these different people while he's building this giant army of formerly enslaved men. He also is fundraising for the Underground Railroad and for this army by kind of playing a little, like, subterfuge game. So when he's interacting with, like, white abolitionists in the North who are his potential donors, he's like, all right, I'll come clean. We're going to do some bad stuff, but do you want to help me do bad stuff? You know, like, do you want to form an alliance? And these people are like, yeah, I'd love to do that. That sounds amazing. But in the South, where he's dealing with people who are heavily invested in plantation slavery, he manages to find people who are like, well, I'll support your Underground Railroad, because that's what he tells them. He's like, I'm just raising money for Underground Railroad to get these people off these terrible plantations. And they're like, well, sure, I'll give you money, because no one would ever run away from my plantation. Like, you know, my plantation.
You gotta tailor your messaging.
Yeah.
You gotta do
right.
it.
Right. He's like, my plantation is wonderful. So, you know, I'll donate to you so that those other plantations can then lose their, you know, enslaved people. And then now I'm back in business, you
it's
know?
Called that's, meeting people where they're at.
Exactly.
You know?
That's exactly what's going on.
Like,
so
doing the work.
Right. So in 1856, the time has come, right? Moses Dixon's like, okay, we're going to finally do this. But then he decides that we're not going to do it. You know, according to him, this is all according to him. And he says in 1856, he's like, well, we decided not to do it because if you're familiar with like the Missouri-Kansas conflicts, all of that is happening in front of his face. Like he's seeing that the Civil War is kind of brewing. He's like, well, why would I launch a rebellion with 46,000 men when the government can do it with a million? You know?
Yes.
So he's like, I'm just going to wait. We'll see what happens. And there are people that kind of use that as a reason to dispute that he actually had this plan. But if you look at rebellions, like slave rebellions that happened in 1856, that is a banner year for it. Yeah. So it seems like maybe that could indicate that there are other people around him who disagree with his decision.
Right.
Which is fascinating, but that's not the coolest thing. I talked about that color convention, right? There are also other Black Masonic-based organizations like the African Mysteries, which is a group based out of Detroit that works on the Underground Railroad. They're also known as the Order of the Men of Oppression, which is metal. So they're, yeah. they're working out of Detroit, throughout the 1850s, they're ferrying in enslaved people from the South to freedom in Northern US and Canada. They said that they aided as many as 50,000 refugees from slavery, with their railroad work. But that is also what Moses Dixon said that his group did. So you're wondering if these groups are actually talking about the overlap of what all of their collective groups are doing during this time period. You also have the Black String Band, which is formed in 1859 by white radical abolitionists in order to protect John Brown from the authorities and from vigilantes. And this group is trying to form a diplomatic relationship with Haiti to convince the Haitians to, like, of course we know John Brown's story of trying to, you know, start an enslaved uprising and free all of these Black people from the chains of slavery. They're also trying to convince the Haitians that, hey, we're going to do this from the North. You should come in from the South and attack through maybe Florida or Louisiana or Alabama, somewhere like that, and help us kind of wipe it out, like smash it in this pincer movement in the institution of slavery. So even after John Brown's death, they still have this going on. And it kind of flares out whenever the Civil War starts, because of course the US Navy is much more active. Haiti also has a lot going on during this time period. Haiti always has a lot
They're
going
busy.
On. Yeah. So yeah. The Haitians are like, you know, I don't really think fighting a giant continent of
they
a country
have any time.
Yeah. That's not really in our cards for right.
Busy.
Yeah. So they decide not to join up with that. And then the Civil War happens. Everything kind of works out for Moses Dixon and friends anyway. But the interesting thing about it is that, like I said, there are people that kind of question, like, did this actually happen? Did Moses Dixon have his army that he says he did? Was it as large as he says it was? You know, but when you look at all the other pieces, everything matches up with what he was saying. And the question is, was he just piggybacking off of their stories, or were they all kind of reporting the same information and like making themselves the star of the story? But like, it's possible that this could have been a barber, a traveling barber.
Yeah.
Working together with all of these different groups across the country to establish something that could have been a legitimate, like we're talking about, if it happens, the third largest uprising of all time. It's just massive. Moses Dixon, after this, maintains a different group called the Knights of Tabor. And that group has hundreds of thousands of members all over the country. And it's supposed to be a fraternal organization. he also works with like the Exoduster movement, the refugees that are coming from Louisiana, and connects with them. So it's just like his body of work before and his body of work after demonstrates that this guy was capable of moving people in this kind of way. But it seems like maybe the Civil War, oddly enough, is the thing that saved our country from being broken up in one way versus another, because the Civil War happens before all of these little revolutionary pieces are ready to strike.
And that's my story.
Where is the
HBO series?
I was going to say, we say this about so many things every time. Weirdest Thing, but like HBO, when?
Yeah.
Like,
it was really the restaurant sidebar. I was like, oh, this is network TV gold.
Yeah.
Man.
Right.
Yeah. There has to be, in this HBO series, there has to be a restaurant scene. It's got to be there.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
And a whole season.
And for the astrology people, the other thing too is Moses Dixon is an Aries. So he's like, ooh.
Oh, he is an Aries.
Ooh, he's an Aries man. So that's another piece of evidence if you're into that. So.
I mean, he's definitely giving Aries man.
Yeah, for sure.
But for good. You know what? We could use some chaotic energy for good.
We could.
I'm here for it.
I love that. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with one more fact.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
The best way to learn a language is immersion. But if that's not in the cards, you can still learn a new language the second best way. And that's with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by more than 200 language learning experts. With Babbel, you can start learning a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's approachable and accessible tools have helped me keep up and even improve my German skills between trips. And Babbel's speech recognition technology is great for helping me improve my pronunciation and accent even when I'm studying alone. With just 10 minutes of practice a day, you can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations. Babbel's personalized learning content, real-time feedback, tracking, and visualizations are designed to help keep you focused and motivated, which makes it really different from most language learning apps on the market. Plus, all of Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by their 20-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at Babbel.com/weirdest. Get up to 60% off at Babbel.com/weirdest. Spelled Babbel.com/weirdest. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Okay, we're back. And it's time for my fact. I have this giant Google Doc, like truly apocalyptically long at large at this point, full of potential ideas for weirdest thing. I used to have a different one every season, but then this one became so massive that I was like, I've used like 10% of the links in here. So I'll circle back to it next year. And, you know, now we don't take breaks anymore. So anyway, it's been my weirdest thing, slush doc, since like 2021, probably. And one of the links that I've had in there for ages is the Wikipedia page for the Greater Honey Guide. But then everything changed when this Atlas Obscura article attacked. So anyway, it became a more interesting story. And so now I'm finally talking about it. The Greater Honey Guide, it's this sub-Saharan bird that it engages in a behavior that is so fascinating to people that its entire genus and its entire family is named for that behavior, even though there are only maybe two species in the bunch that definitely act this way. There's one that's debatable. So their family is Indicatoridae, and their genus is Indicator. And that name comes from the Greater Honey Guide's habit of literally guiding humans to sources of honey. And this is not like a vaguely true folksism either, like, oh, follow the sound of that bird, you'll find honey, which, you know, those things are often totally real. But this is like literally the humans called the birds for help. The birds recognized the request. They logged the ticket and then they helped them find the honey. Research has shown that hunter gatherers are almost 6 times more likely to find hives with a honey guide assist than they are without. The people that are often talked about in relation to honey guides are the Hadza of northern Tanzania. Even if you don't recognize their name, you have almost certainly, I would say definitely, heard of or read research about them, because they're basically the only true hunter-gatherer society that have maintained their traditional way of life, but are not like an uncontacted group. They are in contact with their agrarian and industrialized neighbors. Some of the population, by the way, has started to do some farming or to live in villages. Again, like, this is bound to happen when there isn't some sort of, you know, self-imposed line between you and the rest of the world. But a quarter of them are still hunting and gathering. And those of them that are still do it the same way they've seemingly always done it. And they get all of their food from wild game and plants. So lots of researchers go to hang out with them. They're also, their land is at least somewhat protected by the government. A lot of people will do things like encroach on your way of life and your land if you're like not engaging in capitalism yourself. So unfortunately, it's necessary that they have this sort of official protection. And very fortunately for us, they have historically been very gracious with researchers who come in and hang out with them. So if you've read an article about, for example, like how eating a modern diet versus a traditional hunter-gatherer diet changes your microbiome, it was almost certainly based on research on the Hadza. And by the way, research on them has also shown us that hunter-gatherers, or at least some of them, naturally ate really varied diets that varied a lot seasonally, and in terms of the balance between plants and animal proteins, they are the reason why someone insisting that a paleo diet with, like, you know, no nightshades and only meat is fine if that's what works for you, but not going back to some wholesome, truer ancient human way of life. One surprising thing that researchers have found in studying their diets is how important honey is to their diet. It can make up as much of a fifth of the calories they consume.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, when you think about it, honey is sugar water. It's pretty high in carbohydrates. So again, very anti-paleo diet, but a great get in nature, like in terms of, you know, just sort of giving you energy. It also tastes great. A lot of the articles I read in researching this were like, you know, keep in mind that the flavor of honey is very dependent on what the bees are getting into. And a lot of these honeys are like, have very harsh flavors compared to sort of like farmed honey for mainstream consumers. But still, it's sugar. It tastes pretty good compared to stuff that you can grab off of a tree in like an arid environment in most cases. And also, you know, in a lot of these hunter-gatherer environments, it's available year-round. So it makes sense when you think about it that they consume so much honey. And so, yeah, that brings us to the honey guide bird, which a lot of the Hadza use when they are seeking out honey. And basically, what a lot of researchers say is that if you don't know what's going on, it seems like the men just have this habit of like whistling absentmindedly when they're walking, but it's not. They're doing a very specific whistle to attract the honey guide bird. And then when they hear one of the birds calling back, they like walk towards the sound, keep making noise to get its attention. And then the bird will eventually like be like, I found honey, it's over here. And they like make a huge fuss. And some researchers have estimated that up to 10% of this group's total diet calorically is found with the help of the honey guide bird, which is incredible, right? It's wild. But a lot of popular media on the subject takes things like a little too far in the Disney princess direction of this story. So a lot of depictions of this process, including like documentaries, which I'll get back to in a minute, suggest that this is this mutually beneficial partnership between birds and humans. You know, humans ask for the help, birds provide the help, and then humans always pay the animal for their services with like giant chunks of honeycomb full of wax and grubs, which the honey guide bird loves to eat. But the real story is, you know, a little less perfect fairy tale. Oh, the natural world is so amazing, and these humans live in a simpler, more, you know, harmonious way with nature. So a lot of this comes from an Atlas Obscura article that I'll link to on popsci.com/weird. It's excellent. It's by Kara Jaimo. And it focuses on Brian Wood. And I was like, I know that we've talked about Brian Wood before. And in fact, when I talked about what we can learn from chimps that live past menopause, he has been involved in a lot of the research on that like large chimp habitat where we get a lot of info on their behaviors. So yeah, really, really cool biological anthropology researcher. And he first heard about the honey guide when he was in grad school. And he was like, huh, that's really surprising. You know, this is shared as this example of mutualism, which is when two species are interacting in a way that benefits both of them. And we know that mutualism is really important in the natural world. You get like plants and pollinators, you know, gut microbes and mammals, but it's pretty unheard of for there to be a mutualistic relationship between humans and a wild animal. Like domestication, obviously, you know, was a form of mutualism, but it would just, he was like, this is such a strange, unusual story. It almost sounds too good to be true. And so then he went and actually spent some time with these hunter-gatherers, quite a lot of time, actually. And he was pleasantly surprised to see, like, yeah, these foraging trips often involve looping in the honey guide. And he did a lot of the research on, like, how useful these birds are, that people find more honey, they find bigger nests, they find the honey faster. But he found that, like, contrary to many of the depictions he had seen that had made him surprised, the Hadza tend to, like, go out of their way to destroy the stuff that the bird would eat. They burn it or bury it. Yeah. And well, he was like, you know, this is what we would call a manipulative behavior, or manipulation is an actual term in biology. So it's basically, it's like one animal has acted in a certain way to try to get this other behavior out of the other animal, and it is working, and that has like affected how both of them behave. And yeah, he asked these gatherers to explain why they were doing what they were doing. And he was like, the bird will get too full if we don't do this. And then it won't help someone else. You know, like the bird eats all of the honeycomb and then she's lazy. And you need to know that the birds are going to keep answering humans' calls. And he said, in fact, it like often boiled down to like, I need to make sure my like neighbor doesn't go hungry because I let this honey bird gorge itself and get lazy. And I think, you know, while I didn't find like a specific reference to this, I think the assumption is that like the bird will get some of the wax and the grubs. They're not like meticulously destroying and hiding every morsel, but they're keeping this from being like a huge cash out, and focusing more on limiting the bird's access to its potential payment than they are being like, here it is, my thank you, here is payment for your services. And yeah, Brian Wood, he collected 7 years of data, hundreds of hours of tailing foragers. And then he and his colleagues finally submitted a study on this relationship for publication 2013. And they were like really detailed, like tons of evidence. And actually one of the reviewers of their article responded being like, I know this can't be right because I've seen on YouTube that they pay their honey guides. And there had been a documentary, several, but there was one documentary in particular that this reviewer had referenced that really edited footage to make it seem like, oh, they leave this little payment, they tip their driver, you know. You know, he was like, this is nature faking, which is the term for, you know, manipulating documentary footage and images to make animal behavior seem like something it's not. And it happens so often in documentaries. It's like sometimes maybe unintentional because people are like prone to anthropomorphizing and, you know, want to tell a good story. But it's often like pretty insidious and intentional because people love anthropomorphizing and want to tell a good story. So, yeah, this idea persists. And I will say there are other groups besides the Hadza that do work with honey guides. And it's quite likely, and there is some evidence that a lot of those groups do pay them in a more deliberate way, just sort of their relationship with the bird is different. But it may, you know, this may have something to do with how much of these people's diets rely on honey. Because again, it does seem to be this motivator that's like, you don't want to, if you overfeed the bird, you're hurting another person who's not going to be able to get help from that bird. And again, this awesome Atlas Obscura article, I definitely recommend folks read it, but I will just mention that, you know, the author also talked to some researchers who made the point that, like, this is this really pervasive idea that Indigenous people live in some sort of like harmonious relationship with nature, that, you know, at first glance, it's like it's nice to think of their relationship as harmonious, but it can be dangerous because then, you know, people who do things that strike outsiders as like not being nice or like not being in this perfect harmony with nature can actually face, you know, like a loss of protections that they need to keep surviving on their land.
Right.
So, yeah, people are like, it may seem harmless to sort of keep sharing the like Disneyfied version of how the Hadza interact with their honey guides, but you know, it's like a real bummer that people like think it's less cool if they need to manipulate the bird a little bit, because you know, it's nature. Everybody has to do what they need to do to survive, and it's actually, again, it's like coming from this very sustainable altruistic place. It's just that the bird isn't their main partner. It's the other humans that need to get fed. And the Hanukkahites do fine. They're alive. they're eaten.
Yeah.
Even, you know, I also just want to say that, like, I think this behavior is so still so cool. Like, we don't need the sort of like rosy, oh, these guys are best friends with these birds who they pay fairly for their bird labor. We don't need that for it to be really awesome story of human ingenuity and animal intelligence. More recent research involving Brian Wood and some collaborators, they realized that the Hadza people and the Yao in Mozambique use really different calls to get the honey guys' attention. I'll post links to some clips on pops.com/weird. So the Hadza is that like whistle, really beautiful whistle, actually. You can imagine. You can understand why people who didn't know what was going on were like, they just love whistling. they're whistling right all the time. The Yao call is very different. It's more of like a rumble and a growl. It's hard to describe. It's not a sound I think I would make for any random purpose. And so they realized that they had these very different sounds, and they decided to see whether where a honey guide bird was from would impact like how they responded to these different calls. And indeed, the ones who hang out where the Hadza are from were way more likely to respond to the whistles, and the ones that hang out where the Yao are from were way more likely to respond to the very unbird-like sound that they made. So, you know, this is showing that these birds have learned to respond to these calls. They understand, at least to some extent, what they're being asked to do. It's also, they have really interesting ideas about why the sounds are different. For example, the Hadza, they do some hunting, and the thought is that maybe the whistle came about because sounding like a bird helps them get the bird's attention without freaking out other animals that they might potentially want to hunt.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And the Yao don't hunt mammals with bows and arrows like the Hadza do. So first of all, less of an issue for them to like scare off non-birds, but they may even be trying to sound more like a predator to keep other animals away while they're trying to do their honey finding business. Again, that's like very speculative, but we do know that the sounds they have developed are recognizable to these birds, which is so cool to me. So that's my story about honey and birds and whistling dudes getting some good sugar water out. But yeah, I came across in the course of researching this so many articles that still are like, and the Hadza pay their birds. I even found one article that, and I think this is totally unfounded, I could not find any reference to it in Brian Wood's work. Of course, I could be wrong, but one article just said with like no link to source. So of course, many birds are no longer willing to find honey for them. I'm like, that's not true. They've been doing this for thousands of years. If there are fewer birds, it's probably because people are cutting the trees down.
No, the birds are retiring.
They're trying to start a union.
That was the vibe. Right. Like, obviously, the birds aren't standing for this. I'm like, I think demonstrably they are. They have for probably since before humans were Homo sapiens. But anyway, yeah, very. I love people figuring out cool stuff. And you know, not, listen, many partnerships are not equal, but these birds seem to be doing just fine, and these hunter-gatherers are also looking out for each other, which I think is awesome. A lot of great stuff today. Honestly,
wow,
like,
yeah, there's a lot going much to think about.
much to think about. Yeah, I love when we get a mix of history and animals, and I love when I don't have to apologize for my fact being so depressing. It's I feel like we today was a fun one, a lot of good vibes. Joel, thanks so much for coming on. It was so great to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. This was awesome. I really enjoyed it.
Well, we'd love to have you back sometime. But for now, would you remind listeners where they can find you and your work?
Yeah, so my handles are Freelance Joel on Instagram and on TikTok. And then for Rogue History, if you want to check that out, it is on YouTube under PBS Digital Studios.
The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week is produced by all of our hosts, including me, Rachel Faltman, along with Jess Bodie, who also serves as our audio engineer and editor extraordinaire. Our theme music is by Billy Cadden. Our logo is by Katie Beloff. If you have questions, suggestions, or weird stories to share, tweet us at weirdest_thing. Thanks for listening, weirdos.
Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples. I hate having to deal with seasonal allergies. Luckily for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin clear with Claritin D. Designed for serious allergy sufferers, Claritin D has two powerful ingredients in just one pill that relieve your allergy symptoms and decongest your nose so you can breathe better. It really clears up my congestion and relieves the terrible sinus pressure I get, and it just makes everything so much easier. Ready to live your life as if you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin clear. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.